We're in the green room at the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters at the Sportsman's Lodge, and we're talking with the president of the PPB, Mr. Jack Brown. Jack, thanks for spending some time with us today.
Oh, Chuck, I'm very happy to be here. You went and told everybody where we are. I was going to say, this is the first time I've been in Chicago, then the wind wasn't blowing. but we're on tape, aren't we?
I might get a little windy.
Okay.
I hope not. I hope not.
All right.
Tell us a little bit about the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters. This is its 25th year now, right?
Yes, that's right. In January, we celebrated our 25th anniversary. I'm happy you could be here with us today for the Donald O'Connor Luncheon. It was the 127th luncheon. Now, we're here in sort of a side room of this Sportsman's Lodge restaurant, which is, you know, has huge facilities. We need a really big room. We need a room that'll hold 800 people just so we can have lunch. but when the PPB started, it didn't start in that big Empire room that we were just in. Mm-hmm. It started in this room.
Oh, I see.
And you see the little stage up there.
Yeah, that's right.
And, of course, this room was full, but that was all the people we had.
Now, the founding chairman of the board were Jim Jordan.
No. Let's see. Edgar Bergen was the first chairman of the board.
Okay.
And Art Gilmore was the founding president.
Oh, the founding president.
Right.
Okay.
Then after Edgar died, Jim Jordan became chairman of the board.
Oh, I see.
And he was chairman until he passed away, and then Ralph Edwards took over.
He's
and thank God he's still with us because he's a great chairman.
Absolutely.
He really is.
So the chairman serves for life.
Yes,
that's right.
I see. Yeah. I don't think that's written anywhere, but it just sort of, you know, that's the way
they do such a terrific job.
We get a guy like Ralph Edwards, you know, why would you replace him?
Well, now you're the president of the PPB now, and you've just started your third term,
right?
As president,
I was president about 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. For 1 year.
Oh, I see.
And it's a busy job. Mm-hmm. And I was so very busy at that time that I had to beg off when they wanted me to run for another term, and I couldn't do that. But now that I'm not as busy as I used to be, they came and hit me up again. And so.
Well, that's good.
I said, okay.
That's good.
When the PPB started, originally there were 17 founding members, so it was a small group. Mm-hmm. But they, and Art Gilmore was part of that group and so on, and they would get together. Les Tremaine was part of that group. Now, the organization is a social organization. That's an important thing to remember about it. We're not a charitable organization. We, you know, we don't have any of those aims or goals. The idea was that here in Hollywood, you know, at that time, 25 years ago, a lot of production was going on, and you'd run into your friends, like on Vine Street or Sunset Boulevard or something, in Brittingham's or one of those famous places, you know. Mm-hmm. And we'd just, you say hello in passing, and you're always so glad to see people you've worked with, you know, and whatnot, and haven't seen in a while. So you generally would wind up saying, well, listen, let's have lunch. And, yeah, that's a great idea, but somehow it never worked out. So the founders, I'm a charter member, but I wasn't part of the 17 founders. Mm-hmm. They got there. They said, look, let's have a regularly scheduled, planned lunch, and we all will get together. And so that was really the genesis of the thing.
And now you do this five times a year.
Five times a year.
And at each luncheon get-together, you have a special salute.
Always.
Or someone from the business.
Yes, yes. Now, in January, on our anniversary, we saluted ourselves.
And well, you should.
Yeah. And we did that by having abbreviated versions of some of the top radio shows of all time. And they were recreated on our stage right here with the original cast members. And it was so great.
I'm sorry I missed that one.
Oh, I'm sorry you did too, because it was really wonderful. We had This Is Your FBI, and that was created, you know, by Jerry Devine, and he directed it on that day.
Oh, boy.
And we had Meet Corliss Archer, and we had The Great Gildersleeve, and we had The Importance of Being Earnest from Lux Radio Theater.
Oh,
is what I was trying to think of.
And that started a newcomer, Les Tremaine.
The newcomer. And Jeanette Nolan, of course, was in that. It was really a great day. Norman Corwin read a narration that he had written for CBS many years ago, and it was a very moving part of the program. But that was really fun.
I noticed today, and the room was absolutely packed. There wasn't room for anybody else.
Four days after the tickets went on sale, we were sold out and had a waiting list.
Well, we were grateful that we could sneak in. We probably took the places of a couple of people.
Well, we were happy to have you.
We were delighted to be able to talk a little bit for a minute about the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago.
Yeah.
A nice reception on that, too, by the way.
Yes.
Very nice.
Yep.
But everybody has a smile on their face. Everyone was happy. There was handshaking and hugging and kissing and smiles and back pats and all. It was really nice to see that. And
that's
so many
typical.
People.
That's yeah, exactly what our lunches are all about.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you also have a club room.
Yes.
Because there is... though you're social in nature, you also tend to do some archiving.
You're right.
Right?
We're a social organization, so we don't get any special tax breaks or postage breaks or any of those things, because we don't claim to have a special purpose beyond social. But since it is so easy for us to do, we'd be remiss if we didn't. Among ourselves, you know, contribute what we have in the way of scripts and artifacts and recordings to preserve these things for posterity. Recordings of shows are, you know, thousands and thousands of them are down there. You've seen our club room.
Sure, yes.
But there's at least as much room as you've seen in the other end of the building. It's under lock and key with shelves after shelves, you know, with all of these things filed there. Now, these things, for any scholarly research, we're very happy to make them available as long as there's a PPB member standing by. However, it's not possible for anyone to come in and record any of those things or to borrow anything out of it like a library. No, that can't be done. Because we're protecting the artists involved.
Yes,
As well we should. But and of course it does look a bit like a museum, doesn't it?
Well, you got lots of things on the walls, and some things under
Bing
glass.
Bing Crosby's original microphone.
That's right.
And I think we're using a clip on the microphones. The first little microphone of this sort, I think, was used by Ted Husing. And we have that in our place too.
My goodness, it's amazing.
Yeah,
it's also amazing.
Well, we also have sound effects.
Yes.
Now, what you're hearing now is someone being shot.
They're breaking. In a moment, he'll be shot. Breaking down the walls here of the green room. Jack, in order to become a member of the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, must you have worked out in the Pacific Coast area?
No. Anywhere in the world, as long as you have contributed to broadcasting for at least 20 years.
So you don't have to be a broadcaster from the West Coast.
No, you don't. Don't have to be a broadcaster per se.
I see.
You know, you could be a station owner. Uh-huh. You could be a station secretary. Mm-hmm. You could be someone in an advertising agency.
But you're connected with
broadcasting. You could be a music, someone who has written themes for shows over the years, or a musician.
But
as long as it's connected with broadcasting.
Yes, and 20 years. You need 20.
And a minimum of 20 years. Now, just a musician doesn't qualify by virtue of having made records, for example.
No, because he didn't necessarily broadcast.
No, that's right. Mm-hmm. But if he was involved for 20 years with transcriptions, that would be a different story.
I see. Yes. I see. So we really have a marvelous cross-section of broadcasting here.
Yes.
PPB.
And as I mentioned in your introduction, you would qualify as a member of the PPB by virtue of your experience. Yeah. And the fact that you're so far from the Pacific Coast doesn't apply. That doesn't matter.
Doesn't apply. But if it's a it's not registered as a nonprofit organization.
No. Okay. Now, sometimes that stands in the way of us getting donations for our archives, because people, instead of giving them to the PPB, will give them to some other organization, which allows them to take a tax break for that. But with scripts, that doesn't matter.
Yes.
Or with transcriptions, that doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Because all the tax break you can take on a script is the weight of the paper.
That's right.
They don't, for some reason, they will not consider what's on that paper.
It's pretty much the same thing with a tape.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Well, how much did the reel of tape cost?
Right.
You know, and take a percentage of that. Yeah. That's
ridiculous. You obviously have been in. I say obviously because you are a member and the president of this group. So you have been. No. Well, you don't look. So I'm trying to catch myself real fast. You have been in the business for 20 years or more. Actually, you've been in the business for
50 years or more.
50 years.
Yeah, I'm just grabbing that number off the top of my head, but when I first started as an unpaid performer in juvenile roles in New York. Must have been around 1930, 31. Very first beginning.
Was that radio?
That was radio. Of course. It wasn't television. Uh-huh.
I mean, as opposed to the stage work. I mean.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I did some things on stage, but that doesn't count. Not for this organization.
No. Well, you had worked on what kinds of programs in New York? And what programs? Were you on Let's Pretend?
I was never on a network program. I was on local radio, but always, it was always dramatic. Uh-huh. Either it was some sort of a recitation that I was doing, a monologue or something, or it was a role in a play. One character that I played more than once was Skippy. There used to be in the funny papers, there used to be a guy named Skippy Skinner. and I played Skippy a couple of times. That stands out in my mind because it was such a very dramatic role.
You did that a number of times.
Just a couple of times. Uh-huh. One reason I remember, he had a best friend whose name was Snooky. And Snooky got run over by a train. And so that was my most dramatic role up to that time.
Where did you do most of your radio work over the years?
I spent a great many years with Armed Forces radio television. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In World War II, when the war ended, I was in the Philippines. And the radio station on the island where I was stationed was losing people who were transferring back to the United States, and so they came on the air and they asked for anybody with any radio background at all to come over and audition, and so I borrowed a Jeep and went across the island and auditioned and got the job, and I wound up being assigned to this radio station. I was enjoying myself so much being back in radio, but now full time. When my turn came to leave, I applied for permission to remain on, and I did. I stayed on that one island for 2 years, and I wound up as station manager of WVTK on Samar in the Philippines.
Well, now, what kind of programming would that station have had? You're talking 1945, 46
right? Yes, I am. Yep.
What were you playing? What kind of broadcasting were you doing?
We had disc jockey shows, of course. Mm-hmm. Now, I was, along with being station manager, I was with a disc jockey and a newscaster. Uh-huh. For the disc jockey shows, they were mostly big band shows. Uh-huh. And we had big band recordings, that had been re-recorded on AFRTS labels or AFRS labels. Yeah. And we also had V-discs. And we had, so we had some of the greatest, what I think are the greatest music of all time, and we had great, great shows. For news, we had a system where we would listen to shortwave radio with earphones, and someone back on the West Coast would read the news to us at what they called dictation speed. So everything was said twice. They would say, like, in Washington today, and then they would repeat, in Washington today, and then anything that was at least bit doubtfully would spell the word. Well, knowing how short wave can be that many miles away, a lot of static and whatnot and fading, it sometimes was very hard to get a complete news story out of it. But then once we got it all, then we could go on the air on our station and give it at regular speed, and it sounded just like we were just tied with the world.
They were not feeding it in your ear while you were broadcasting.
No,
were transcribing it.
No.
Didn't record it, but you just...
beginning, we didn't even have tape recorders, and we certainly didn't have a disc recorder in a little tiny station in the jungle, So it meant we had to copy it down manually and then rewrite it into a regular newscast and then come on later and deliver it.
How many people would be assigned to such a radio station?
Four or five, maybe.
There were
a lot of them. Were a lot bigger, but it just so happens that mine was very small.
Were you on
and
the
we all doubled and tripled. Yeah.
Around the clock? Were you around the clock 24 hours?
No. We signed off at night and, around taps, and we signed back on around Reveille.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so that helped.
Almost sunrise to sunset.
Yeah, just about. We were almost one of those.
Did you get a supply of the AFRS versions of the stateside broadcast?
You bet. They were decommercialized.
Yes, right.
But we did. We got a shipment of the network shows every week, big trunk full of the 16-inch transcriptions.
What did you do with those things when you were through with them?
Well, we tossed them. I hate to tell you that. You see, we had to make sure that they didn't fall into the wrong hands. This was something we were charged with when we were allowed to have these discs. And it would be too expensive to ship a vinyl pressing back to the United States. There wouldn't be any purpose in it. So what we had to do was make sure they were destroyed.
I see.
And sometimes the easiest way to do that was what they called deep six.
Into the deep blue sea.
Into the deep blue sea, right. Yeah.
So maybe if we went out there with the equipment that went to raise the Titanic, we could have a...
If they can find five airplanes in the Bermuda Triangle, then they can probably find some transcriptions in the Philippines. Yeah.
Did you cover that whole island?
Yes.
The Philippines? Covered the whole Philippines with
Philippines. No, there are thousands of islands in the Philippines. I'm just on one of the biggest.
Now, the Armed Forces Radio Service had counterparts then to your station, really all over the world, didn't they?
Yes. Yeah. Now, I was part of a network, but not... It wasn't a hardwired network. I mean, we couldn't share programming that way. But we were administratively linked. So what they call the Far East Network, prior to that was the Mosquito Network. And the Far East Network was headquartered in Manila at that time, and the station in Manila was WVTM. And there were stations on Cebu. There were stations, in different parts of the Philippines. All part of this network. And then later, when it became possible, the headquarters moved to Japan and set up in Tokyo, the Far East Network.
Was it fascinating work for you? Obviously, if you re-enlisted to stay there.
I didn't re-enlist, but I extended, which is not quite the same thing. But but it was fascinating. I was enjoying it tremendously, virtually every aspect of it. Yeah.
Well, now you spent a great deal of time. I think you spent some notes that I have here said you were spent more than 35 years with the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
So, how much of that was related with the Armed Forces Radio?
Almost all of it.
Virtually all of it. Huh?
Now, I had been in the service a few years. I went in 1942, so I'd been in maybe 3 years by the time I finally got assigned to AFRS at the end of the war. When I finally did return back to the United States, happily for me, they recommended that I be assigned to AFRS headquarters in Hollywood. So that was what brought me to Hollywood. And then when I got out of the service at the end of my term, which was in October of 1948, within 60 days or so, someone called and asked me if I would like a temporary job as a civilian at Armed Forces Radio. Historically, this is interesting because it was the McCarthy era.
Oh.
And Senator McCarthy was doing his ridiculous thing, and people were suspect. If you ever read a book with a red cover, you were suspect. And so this hit the armed forces because everyone that worked there had a clearance, a security clearance. So, boy, they came down on the newsroom there, and they suspended this one fellow because way back in his college days, they thought he had a suspicious affiliation. And so I was hired to come in for those 90 days and replace him. Well, at the end of the 90 days, he was back. I mean, it was all absurd. And I was out, but only for a week or so because somebody else left permanently, and I got a full-time job there. And I stayed there until the Korean War. And I got recalled into active duty, and I went to Korea. And I didn't have anything to do with Armed Forces Radio during that period of time. And when I got back to the United States at the end of the Korean War and got out of the service again, I went back down to Armed Forces Radio. I said, well, I'm back. And they said, yeah, that's nice. Where are you going to work? I said, well, I'm just going to take my old job back. They said, no, we eliminated that job while you were gone. So here I was, a young married guy with a kid, and thinking I had a job waiting. So I wound up, I was on the radio. I went on the radio. I was driving a radio-controlled taxi cab.
Once a broadcaster, always a
broadcaster. That's right, sure. So I drove this cab at night, in Hollywood while I spent my days looking for a job. And eventually my looking paid off. I was offered three jobs, and I was so hungry by then I took two of them. I worked one days and one nights. One of them was at Armed Forces Radio. It was a night job as a news writer. And so I got back in with AFRS then. Stayed with them for quite a long time. And at one point there, I left to go into television. I had my own TV show on Channel 7 here in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and a daily program.
Now, what kind of a show was that?
I was a cowboy. It was a kids' program.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Cowboy Jack?
Yeah, well, no, I was the kid from Powder River Ranch. They called me Powder River for short. Had a big horse named Cheyenne. Yeah, it was a great experience. Yeah, and when that was fun while it lasted. Mm-hmm. When the show finally went the way of all shows, luck would have it, a job opened up again at Armed Forces Radio, and I worked there again and worked my way up until eventually I was director, Armed Forces Radio director for programming. Uh-huh. Radio and television.
And now, and this was when? Maybe in the late 50s or?
Well, let's see. My television show was sometime in 50 or 51, I guess, mm-hmm. right around there, because I was a real TV pioneer. It was really early in the game.
Uh-huh.
It was live. Everything was live then, you know.
And more fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. It was kind of exciting.
Yeah, sure.
But dates are kind of running together here. I'd have to do some research. But I stayed with the AFRS primarily as my primary uh-huh. thing. I was teaching at night. That was the other job.
Yes.
I was teaching broadcasting.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so I did that for most of my career, too. And when I left as director for programming, I retired. I had 35 years plus with the government by then. And I retired. So I'm happy to say they gave me the Defense Meritorious Service Medal for my
wonderful
work. I was very proud of that. Yeah, for a period of time, I had been doing acting on the side, mm-hmm. and so then when I retired there, I continued doing commercials.
And now you're still doing some of that work?
Well, mm-hmm. I other things happened too. Well, I continued doing that all the time. But I did, I bought a radio and television school, the Don Martin School, which I owned for a while with my sons.
Mm-hmm.
And then we sold that. I went to work at California State University, Northridge. I was a part-time faculty member in the radio, television, film department. And I did that for a year and a half or so. And then I became a full-time administrator out there as general manager of their public radio station. I stayed there over 5 years, and then I retired from there. So the only thing I haven't retired from is doing commercials. I'm still doing commercials.
And we hear your voice on what kind of, which commercials?
Well, right at this very moment, I'm on in Chicago for Illinois Bell.
Uh-huh.
I'm also on in a telephone spot for Michigan and, Wisconsin, Michigan and Wisconsin Bell, yeah, mm-hmm. or Wisconsin and Michigan, whichever way it is. I'm on nationally for Blockbuster Video and Heinz Ketchup. And I'm also mm-hmm. the industrial spokesman for the Kubota Tractor Corporation. So I keep doing industrial things for them.
So you're really keeping pretty busy, aren't you?
Right now, nothing's keeping me quite so busy as a Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, I must say.
It takes a lot to run an organization like this. I know
it
you
does.
Have an able board and a good crew of officers.
Well, I was going to say, this is what keeps this organization going.
Mm-hmm.
I wish you could attend one of our board meetings sometime. Mm-hmm. Now, there might be, at our next board meeting, there might be 50 people there. I mean, it's not, six people sitting around a big table.
Yeah.
You know, it's a meeting of a lot of people, and they last quite a long time. I mean, several hours, uh-huh. And we have experts. We just have a room full of experts on so many things, and they are all volunteers. You saw this luncheon today with almost 800 people
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
All of those seat assignments had to be made. They have a system of making sure that people that sat in the back last time sit toward the front this time, and things like they have smoking and no smoking and all of this. It's a big job. Not one penny is spent for anyone to do that job. That's all done by PPB volunteers.
Well, I was describing the people at the luncheon today before, and I was talking about the smiles on their faces and the pats on the back and the handshakes and the hugs.
We're also glad to see each other.
Well, not only that, I think there's something else that was running through the whole audience that was wonderful. It was enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great enthusiasm mm-hmm. on the part of these people. I mean, you all shared something wonderful.
Yeah.
The radio and the TV days, and it's nice that that everyone is still enthusiastic about this.
But don't you think that kind of goes with the personalities that gravitate toward entertainment?
Yes, sure.
See, that's really, it's innate.
But I think perhaps the fact that there is such an organization like this keeps a lot of people who are not any longer active in the business keeps them in touch and involved in working in getting one of these things together
that's
and
true.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. But I must say, though, that some of the most active people on our board, and that board includes the 21 board members, but it also includes permanent committee chairs and officers and so on. And some of the most active are people who are still working regularly.
But well, they always say, if you want someone to do the job, ask a busy person.
Right? You bet. They do, don't they? I guess with good reason. Yes. You know.
It's been
now,
a,
for example, you know, our I would you know we have a thing which I think is extremely important because of what it's doing, you know, for posterity. Mm-hmm. We have an audio histories department. We get members to come down and sit down and in a very nice, comfortable setting in our club rooms in the studio there, and be interviewed about their professional background, their career, and then later someone takes that tape and transcribes it, you know, for the files. And we have, you know, millions of words now of audio histories that have been compiled over the years. Les Tremaine, who was chairman of our Nostalgia Nights for 14 years, has also been doing these audio histories for 17 years. So I'll give you an example, And Lord knows he's still working and he's busy, but he finds time to do it.
Well, he does a good job on that, too.
Yes, yes.
Now, you mentioned the Nostalgia Night, which is another activity of the PPB.
Yes.
This is monthly, I guess, from September through May or June. And it's at the clubhouse.
May, through May, that's
through
right.
May. Yeah. And here you have, it's just an evening with someone who comes in and talks about all the things that they've done in their career.
Yes.
And it's filled and they have all kinds of people coming
in. That's right, yeah. Yeah, we just, a couple months ago we had Stacy Keach, you know, who, and the wonderful series he did about the Texas Rangers, you know. You know, it's so interesting that sometimes the very people that are being talked about, the very stars that are being reminisced about from by the guest star that evening, are right there in the audience, you know. And so after little tapes and are played, you know, either audio tapes or videotapes, and you know, these recollections are marvelous, then there's questions and answers, you know, because it's a very intimate setting. And we're all just friends together conversing. And there's, you know, coffee and cookies, and we just have a really great evening. That, you know, that club room is a, which is in the Home Savings building at the corner of Sunset and Vine. That was the site of NBC's
NBC.
And before that, it was that block was where the very first movie in Hollywood, The Squaw Man, was made. By Cecil B. DeMille, I believe. And that, so that explains the facade on the building.
Yes.
Has
beautiful
Hollywood
building,
Yes, isn't it? Well, we have in there a fine radio studio. Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I pressed the cough button, but nobody coughed.
Didn't work,
Yeah, so we have in there an actual radio. We have Ampex tape machine number one. Still working in beautiful condition. Well, we have some gifted engineers that are part of our club. And a nice studio. And Les conducts these interviews there. Mm-hmm. But we also have, in addition to the little voice studio in the control room, a stage. And the, and that's where the Nostalgia Night things are. Well, on that stage with Les, I was happy enough to, I'm happy to say, we recorded a book on the history of radio called Please Stand By, A History of Radio, which was published by the Southern California Consortium of Community Colleges. And it's a credited course in the history of radio for use in community colleges countrywide. And so that includes, in addition to the book, it includes a series, 30 programs, half-hour programs, each one on a different chapter in the book on the history of radio, and illustrations are used in these programs. In the course of the series, there are over 400 excerpts of famous radio programs. You know, you can hear the announcer at the burning of the Hindenburg Zeppelin, you know, and you can hear the first man on the moon. You know, that this whole,
the whole spectrum.
Even from before recording days, because things from back in the early days when radio was just being developed, being thought of, we hired some of the most famous actors in Hollywood to come in and recreate things. So it's really a fascinating course.
Now, this is a course being taught out here. now?
No, it's available to colleges countrywide.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And is the book available to anybody?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it can be purchased directly from the consortium.
The book is called Please Stand By, A History of Radio.
Yes,
right?
And it comes with a folder with all the tapes, you know, cassettes in there with all the lectures.
Oh.
And that's, Les is doing these. Oh, excuse me. Better flag the tape here.
We'll take it.
So Les, of course, and I are doing the lecture portions of this mm-hmm. thing, and it's great fun because we're really talking about the most important and the best things that ever happened in the medium.
Well, that's fascinating. We have to get a hold of that and listen
to
that.
Oh, I think the museum should have a copy.
Sure
the Museum
do.
Of Broadcast
yes,
Communications.
Absolutely,
yes.
Yeah. Marvelous. Jack, I can't tell you how much it means for us to have been able to spend some time out here, not only with you, but with the pioneers today. This is a marvelous organization contributing an awful lot. And, my gosh, you know, they always say, gee, if a bomb ever hit this building, what would happen to the business, you know, or what would happen to all of this?
Yeah.
Some of the absolutely great, great voices from the radio days and some of the other personalities from the TV days were all together here on
yes.
this one roof at the Sportsman's, and
that's
it was marvelous
right.
to see these
yeah.
people. You look across the room and I saw Gene Autry seated over there.
Yeah,
and then you look
former
another,
board member. Yeah,
yeah, and then I saw June Foray and Don DeFore, who did yeah. television he was the neighbor, I
that's
think,
right.
and Ozzie and Harriet. And
well, he had his own show, too,
oh,
Hazel.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, it was in Hazel. Yeah. And, of course, he did a lot of movie work. And,
yes.
And just all around this.
Everywhere you turn, sure.
Living history, I guess you could say.
Yeah,
and so what has been done by the pioneers to bring these folks together and what people like Les have done to record their recollections of these things is marvelous.
Yes. And it can only become more valuable as time goes on.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Because as you get further away from those days, you sad to say, we lose. As I look around here at the Pacific Pioneers meeting, I found so many people who represented the radio days as much as the television days, and I sensed a real appreciation here for the radio and the early days of broadcasting. There is a special fondness for radio within this organization.
Yeah, it still is, but I mean, not as much the way we would like it, perhaps. But it's a very special medium mm-hmm. because of the way it involved us as listeners. You know, the television, you're not that involved,
yes.
really.
Uh-huh.
If they don't show it to you on the screen, it doesn't exist.
Right.
With radio, you had to use your imagination, mm-hmm. but it wasn't any effort because, you know, all the stimuli were given to you and wonderful pictures yeah. popped into your mind and these beautiful people spoke and you were part of it because you were creating it yourself with their help. And unfortunately with TV, it doesn't demand or encourage that kind of participation. As good as it is, and I make my living from
yeah,
TV,
right,
you know,
yeah.
but radio is so special.
Yeah, special to us. This yeah. has been a special time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I'm sorry you really had to pump things out of me. It's like pulling
yeah,
teeth.
Yeah, it was tough. It was really tough. Les Tremaine said that, watch out for Jack Brown, because he's a hard guy to talk to.
I know. Chuck, it's been a pleasure being here with
Same
you.
Same here. Thank you.